This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. The Hanoi summit between the United States of America's President Donald Trump and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea's chairman Kim Jong-un ended early and without an agreement covering what each side sought most. Pyongyang dismantling its nuclear program and the United States lifting its strong sanctions regime on North Korea. Hello, I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel. The outcome of this meeting in Vietnam's capital raises two key questions. First, why did this Trump-Kim meeting fail to produce any concrete results? And secondly, where do discussions between Washington and Pyongyang go from here? Joining me here in the studio to analyze the summit and its outcome are Mr. Richard Johnson, Senior Director for Fuel Cycle and Verification at the Washington-based research organization Nuclear Threat Initiative. Richard Johnson has held a series of nuclear proliferation control roles in the United States government, including serving as a U.S. monitor at North Korea's Yongbyon nuclear facility. Also joining us, Mr. Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow for national security at the Washington-based research organization Center for American Progress. Encounter comes to you from the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Let's start the discussion. President Trump announced Thursday at the end of his talks with Chairman Kim that no agreement had been reached, citing North Korea's insistence that international sanctions placed against Pyongyang for nuclear activity, human rights violations, and other reasons be lifted before any agreement on dismantling DPRK's nuclear program could be forged. I want to ask both of our guest analysts their perspectives on this outcome. Considering Pyongyang's long-standing order of priorities, is there anything that the U.S. team preparing President Trump for these talks could have done differently to try to achieve some measure of progress? You've been on the ground in North Korea, Mr. Johnson. What do you think?
Well, listen, I think negotiations with North Korea are always a massive challenge. We have a huge number of issues on the table, not just the denuclearization question, but also the issue of the long-standing status of the war that has still not been technically ended, and the lack of normalization of relations between the United States and North Korea. So it's a big, big basket of things. In my view, the only way to tackle these things is to break them up in a piece-by-piece, step-by-step process. So in terms of how could President Trump have been more prepared, I do think that process matters. It sounds like a boring thing from a Washington perspective, but I think it's important that the President of the United States and Chairman Kim empower their envoys to go into a room, lock the door, and start writing in detail the kinds of things that they would like to see happen. That will be a tough negotiation, and it will take some time, but it's the only real way to make progress. You can't do that just at a leader-level summit.
And what's your perspective on this, Mr. Fuchs?
Well, I completely agree with Richard. I think that the key questions that we have to tackle in this diplomacy, as in any diplomacy with North Korea over the years, is whether or not North Korea is willing to take concrete and verifiable steps to change its behavior. That is the fundamental question. Now, you need very, very careful, comprehensive, and effective diplomacy to try to test what North Korea's intentions are and to get an answer to that fundamental question. Unfortunately, I think over the first year or so of this diplomacy between the two countries, between 2018 and today, the president has unfortunately undermined the ability of the United States to have an effective diplomatic approach. He started this entire process just about a year ago by announcing out of nowhere that he was going to have a summit with Kim Jong-un. Before any negotiating had happened, before there was any sense of what issues should be on the table, the president put the cart before the horse. He did that again just last fall by agreeing to a second summit without any agreement in place. And so again, I think I agree with Richard. The real negotiators need to get down to brass tacks before there are any more summit meetings.
From what I know as a journalist from the summits that I've covered in the past, I know, like you know, that there is a whole protocol before you have a summit. There are all of these advance meetings. And for instance, in this issue, there would be advance meetings on hardware, meaning there would be meetings about specific nuclear devices. There would be meetings on delivery systems. There would be meetings on sites where enrichment is taking place. And each one of these teams, there would be a team assigned just to protocol as to which sequence is followed in which order. And I don't see any of this. Maybe all of this did take place, and perhaps we should give the White House credit for this. But in advance, at least publicly, I did not get that sense of preparation.
I completely agree with you. Now, look, I think that there are a number of arguments that people are making here to give the president the benefit of the doubt, which I am not wont to do usually. But if you were, there was an argument that unlike previous diplomatic rounds with North Korea, what was lacking was leader-to-leader engagement, a top-down approach that Kim Jong-un can bless from the outset to empower his negotiators. Even if you don't agree with that, which I don't necessarily, they did that. They did that in Singapore. They charted out a vague course, and then the negotiations supposedly got started from there. The problem then, of course, was that there was no real follow-up. The North Koreans actually, from what we understand, evaded working-level negotiations on a number of times, not showing up to a couple of meetings, at least with their U.S. counterparts. And yet, despite that lack of detailed progress, negotiations, as you were talking about, President Trump agreed to do another summit, which I think, again, was a mistake.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with Mike on this. I would say that the silver lining potentially coming out of Hanoi is the last sentence in the White House's statement, which basically says that they look forward to having additional meetings in the near future at the working level. Now, obviously, that's very vague diplomatic speak that I'm used to delivering myself. However, Secretary Pompeo, just before we came into the studio, said that while he did not expect to see a summit anytime soon, a third summit, I mean, he did expect that Special Representative Steve Biegun was hopefully going to get together with his counterpart, Kim Hyok-chol, to start talking about these things. And so process really matters. If you look at the Iran nuclear deal and how that was negotiated, that was done in an extremely intensive way with a lot of smaller level working groups. I mean, I'm not talking about just at the Secretary of State level, where in fact you had John Kerry in Vienna for something like 14 days, which is amazing, you know, kind of a thing. But my technical colleagues were very much there on the ground constantly and dealing with extremely technically minute matters. If you look at that deal, it's about 145 pages long. That's the kind of thing we're going to be looking at for North Korea.
Since we've already brought it up, I do want to touch on June 2018, when U.S. President Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim met in Singapore. They signed an agreement working for what the American leader said was, quote, complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, unquote. At the time, President Trump announced that the sanctions would remain in place until the U.S. felt assured, as the president put it, that nuclear weapons, quote, are no longer a factor, unquote. Well, meanwhile, Chairman Kim's position that sanctions must be lifted first was no different then than it is now. So in light of what has just happened in Hanoi, what is the current market value of the agreement signed in Singapore? What's the value of that paper?
Well, look, I think Singapore was very high on symbolism and very low on substance. The one positive thing about the Singapore statement is it does lay out the three key areas where both sides would like to make progress. I might take issue with the order of that statement in which denuclearization comes third, but it does talk about ending the war, building better U.S.-North Korea relations, and this concept of working towards complete denuclearization. So I think the statement is a framework. What I would have liked to have seen out of Hanoi is something more concrete about how to implement that framework. As I said, at a bare minimum, if we hope that Steve Biegun and Kim Hyok-chol can start to put some meat on those bones, that would be a positive outcome. But right now, what we're looking at is simply a framework document that talks about these broad goals. And as you said, the concept of denuclearization is a very fraught term. We don't necessarily know what the North Koreans mean by that. We think we know what the United States means by that, which is the removal of all North Korean nuclear weapons. But even that is something that has to be negotiated in some level of detail.
Mike Fuchs, what do you think?
Look, I agree with Richard, but I really think that Singapore is now ancient history when it comes to these negotiations. Again, whatever you think about it, was it a good idea to meet at the outset? Was it a bad idea? It doesn't really matter at this point. The statement, as Richard pointed out, was quite vague. It had some general areas of focus. It said a bunch of things that I think a lot of people knew already and sort of got everyone off to the races. The problem is that the race hasn't moved very far from where it started in Singapore. And so now we're at the fundamental question, again, that has always been the problem in these negotiations, which is how much sanctions relief for how much denuclearization. After Trump was wheels up back to Washington, D.C., the North Korean foreign minister held his own rare press conference in Hanoi, trying to spin the narrative to the North Korean advantage, claiming that actually the North Koreans only wanted partial sanctions relief for what they were asking. And so I think we'll see in the coming days and weeks a little bit of the he said, she said narrative play out here. But again, it's all about that fundamental question that we can't get past. How much sanctions relief for how much denuclearization?
Pain for gain. It's that simple. If you inflict a large amount of pain, you're hoping to achieve a specific result. And this is what sanctions have been intended for all of this time. If you put enough hurt on somebody, maybe they'll holler and say, okay, enough, whatever you want. Okay, well, obviously, in the case of the Kim and the regime in Pyongyang, they don't just throw up their hands and say, okay, enough. This is not world wrestling. This is a nuclear state, and this is international diplomacy, and it doesn't work that way. This is not a cage match. I do want to bring up a third point before we go into a break. Complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Well, this would mean not only removing DPRK's nuclear arsenal, but complete denuclearization would also mean taking out any nuclear deterrent shield the United States has placed over South Korea. Taking out the nuclear factor leaves a massive North Korean conventional military, which has never, ever forgotten Kim Il-sung, the founder of the current Korean state's dictum, and that is that the 1950 Korean War was a war of liberation of the Korean Peninsula. The military has never abandoned that. I have never seen anything abandoning that dictum. So, if we want to move towards denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, what defensive shield does that provide for South Korea? Which one of you gentlemen would like to go first?
Well, I would just say that, first of all, the concept of the term complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is a term that we've been using for many, many years. It goes back multiple administrations. And so I think that, yes, that term is a bit in the eye of the beholder. I would take some question to your statement that that means, by definition, that all of the nuclear umbrella over South Korea, various assets would have to be removed from the region. In some cases, yes, I think North Koreans have implied that or even said that explicitly. However, we have also heard stories from senior leaders who have gone to Pyongyang in the past who have been told that, in fact, maybe they wouldn't mind having an existing U.S. presence on the peninsula, frankly, to balance against China, which the North Koreans are also concerned about. So I do think that denuclearization has to be negotiated. It has to be technical. And yes, it might mean some change there, but I don't think we should assume what that means.
What's your thought, Mr. Fuchs?
No, I think that, again, Richard and I are in vigorous agreement. And I think that fundamentally here, we're still stuck in the same spot, again, that we have been for a long time.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for regular host Carol Castiel. My guests on this edition of Encounter, covering the U.S.-North Korean summit in Hanoi, are Mr. Richard Johnson, the Senior Director for Fuel Cycle and Verification at the Washington-based research organization Nuclear Threat Initiative, and Mr. Michael Fuchs, Senior Fellow for National Security at the research organization Center for American Progress in Washington. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Speaking of Facebook, here's a big shout out to an Encounter fan in Vietnam, Soyen Nguyen. Thank you for listening. If you want to hear your name and country mentioned on Encounter, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or give us a like and leave a comment on our Facebook page. If the United States and the DPRK came to an agreement under which Pyongyang would dismantle its nuclear program, how would such an agreement be structured? Would it be along the lines of the U.S.-Russian START agreements, which not only limited warheads but also delivery systems like intercontinental ballistic missiles? Would it be structured like the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action under which Iran agreed to curb nuclear activity, built on a set of protocols, targets to be reached, and open verification by competent authorities such as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA? What would get the job done? Just as importantly, what would Pyongyang be willing to accept? Mr. Fuchs, you're up, Pat.
Richard is definitely the expert on the details of this, but I think what I can safely say is that you'll need a very, very significant and comprehensive verification system in place to actually ensure that whatever the North Koreans are agreeing to is actually being done. But I think it's also important to note that any agreement is likely to only be, especially at the outset, an interim agreement, a partial agreement. It is highly unlikely that we are to see in the foreseeable future North Korea saying, here are all of our nuclear weapons, all of our facilities, all of our missiles, and hand them over all in one fell swoop. And so we're going to see something, if we see anything, that happens in a very piecemeal approach.
Mike is absolutely right. And I would point to, you mentioned the JCPOA. That, in fact, was a phased process as well. It started with the Joint Plan of Action, which was an interim deal that did freeze some programs and had limited sanctions relief for Iran. I could see something similar here in North Korea, maybe with multiple phases rather than just two in the case of Iran. If I had my pick, I think the thing that's most important is to put a freeze right now on North Korea's production of fissile material. This is the highly enriched uranium and the plutonium that's produced and used in their nuclear bombs, primarily at a location called Yongbyon, but there is concern that they might possibly have undeclared locations somewhere else. So the key to be would be to, number one, declare where they have these locations for production, and number two, bringing in the international inspectors from the IAEA, who are the independent body that does this, to verify that North Korea is doing what it said it would do. That would be the basis for something, and then the next step would be things like getting the nuclear material out of the country, and then getting at the nuclear weapons themselves.
Many times these situations begin with, and I hate to use a boilerplate term, interim confidence-building steps. Okay? I mean, fellow Washingtonians, we hear this term all the time. How would we apply this in this particular circumstance? What would be a couple of good confidence-building steps that would give us a greater certainty that maybe Pyongyang wants to play somewhat fair?
Well, I think one of the things that was potentially on the table for Hanoi that we didn't see emerge is the idea of opening liaison offices. I think that this is something that North Korea has actually opposed in the past, either because they didn't want to be so politically connected to Washington or because they wanted to go straight to an embassy and get that full recognition. I'm not saying that liaison offices will solve all the problems, but if you're getting into a phased process and you are, as you say, building confidence, we're not going to have trust right away. We're going to have distrust. But if you have people on the ground that can talk to each other day to day, that helps to bridge a lot of communications gaps.
Every president wants to leave their mark on history. It's just a matter, you know, goes with the job. For President George W. Bush, it was the overthrow of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. However, the aftermath of that wasn't exactly what they anticipated. One of the signature aspects of the presidency of Barack Obama was the JCPOA, as we've been discussing, the Iran nuclear deal, which was supported by a broad swath of the international community, but his successor, President Trump, decided that he was no longer going to follow. Now, many speculate that Mr. Trump wants his own signature historical international achievement. Could it be a deal with North Korea? Is this what he's looking for? I know you're not reading his mind, but this man wants a mark on history. Is this possibly what he's trying to do?
Mike can speak to this further, but I would just say that's a good thing because we want to have diplomacy with North Korea. Diplomacy is always better than the alternative. The concern is, and Mike alluded to this, is we don't want to give away too much and get too little. And so if the idea is he's focused on getting a good deal with North Korea, that's a very, very positive thing, but the devil's in the details.
Yeah, no, I again completely agree. And I think that over the last year or so since this diplomacy between the United States and North Korea began, President Trump, frankly, has been too eager to look like he really wants a deal, and he has repeatedly acted as though he already had achieved victory or success when it comes to North Korea. He tweeted out after the Singapore summit last June that there was no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea, which of course is completely false. And so the president has been too overeager so far. The one potential silver lining in the summit that we just saw in Hanoi is that whatever happened at the table that broke down those talks, the president clearly was not willing to walk away and spin this as a giant victory. And so it's a big question, obviously, is where that goes now. I frankly hope, as Richard pointed out, that he still wants some kind of progress here, but it's got to be real progress and not some sort of reality TV show.
Well, we've seen the man-to-man summit. We've seen this president engage in man-to-man engagements before, and I didn't mean to use the word twice, but there it was. Previous administrations engaged North Korea through multilateral talks that included China and others that have a stake and influence in Pyongyang. The current administration, as we said, appears to favor man-to-man discussions rather than conventional structures. The question for each of you, without China and others at the table, can any real substantive agreement that'll hold over time be reached? Mr. Johnson, what do you think?
Well, you have to incorporate the region whatever you do. Right now, the model is bilateral, but I completely agree that you're going to have the involvement of China, Russia, South Korea, and Japan to make this thing actually work. In the 2000s period, we had the six-party talks where we all sat together and had these negotiations. Now, some would argue that was too cumbersome, and it's better to go bilaterally. It doesn't matter either way you structure it, but you have to have that buy-in. One of the things that I would say here that you could do is if you can start to get a nuclear deal, you can ask the participants in that region to start to contribute through technical support, monetary support, and follow a model similar to what we did in the Soviet Union, the so-called Nunn-Lugar approach, in which we actually went in and helped to convert former Soviet nuclear facilities and make sure that there was no longer a threat of proliferation, moving weapons and destroying missiles. And this is where I would say denuclearization is not something that should be done to North Korea. It should be done with North Korea. And this will build some sustainability and reassurance to the North Koreans that other partners in the region are bought into this concept.
Look, I am going to, for the first time in our conversation, just respectfully differ just slightly with Richard. While I completely agree that the region needs to be involved and the United States needs to be coordinating with the region, fundamentally, the problem right now, and frankly for a long time, has been between the United States and North Korea. North Korea wants to negotiate with the United States, and frankly, the United States has its own particular problems with North Korea. And so I think until those two countries are able to get over at least the initial stumbling blocks of some sort of an interim deal, or at least understanding of what denuclearization is and what kind of terms these negotiations are going to happen on, I think that that is the major thing that we need. And the only other component I would add to this is making sure that the United States is keeping South Korea in the loop. We haven't talked at all about South Korea, obviously. The North and the South are engaged in their own serious detente right now, which is incredibly important. The South very much wants to see U.S.-North Korea talks succeed right now. I mean, the United States needs to be taking into consideration the interests of its ally in Seoul as well.
And then there's the issue of what we would call, in broad terms, behavior change. What do we have with North Korea? We have a totalitarian state. We have a regime that uses starvation as a political weapon, as punishment. This is a narco state. North Korea is responsible for the production of a massive quantity of illegal drugs that get shipped all over the world. North Korea is also one of the world's biggest counterfeiters of American currency. I mean, we've been spending this program talking about the summit and nuclear issues, but when you're talking about building a relationship with North Korea, North Korea is committing crimes against the United States and other nations by engaging in counterfeiting and in drug activity and many other things that it does, kidnapping citizens, people of Japan, etc. So it looks like there's a big order of things that have to be fixed before we can say, welcome North Korea to the responsible community of good nations. They're quite a ways from that. Your thoughts?
Well, I would say absolutely. We have to be very clear-eyed about the regime that we are working with here. They have huge prison camps. You talked about some of the counterfeiting issues, the drug issues. No, this is not the nicest place in the world to live. So I do think you have to take a step back and look at the broader approach. The most immediate threat to U.S. national security is definitely this nuclear program. And so it makes sense to start there. But we sure should not just say, oh, these are all great guys. And, you know, once we take care of this, everything will be, you know, hunky-dory. And I would add to your list, by the way, cyber, where the North Koreans have been very active in trying to to target U.S. corporations and the U.S. government in hacking into our systems, and that's a big problem.
And how would you like to sum it up, Mr. Fuchs?
I think the best analogy for this is actually the JCPOA and the negotiations over the deal with the nuclear deal with Iran. Just because those negotiations were happening and just because they ended in an actual deal to address the nuclear program, it did not take off sanctions that were on Iran on other issues. It did not stop us from speaking out or doing things to push back against Iranian malign behavior in the region and their own abuse of their people's human rights. And so I think a similar approach is necessary here.
This is Encounter from the Voice of America. This edition of Encounter featured analysts Mr. Richard Johnson, the Senior Director for Fuel Cycle and Verification at the Washington Research Organization Nuclear Threat Initiative, and Mr. Michael Fuchs, Senior Fellow for National Security at the Washington-based research organization, the Center for American Progress. Encounter was produced here at VOA headquarters in Washington. Special thanks to Patrice Martin, who brings in Encounter's experts. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another topic on Encounter, right here on the Voice of America.